comments contained in this podcast do not constitute legal advice. The opinions herein are the opinions of the speakers and not the official opinion of the Hodgson Russ Law Firm. Hey there, tax fans. Welcome to State Tax Talks with me, your host, Joe Tantillo. I'm a tax attorney at the Hodgson Russ Law Firm looking to explore the nuances of state and local tax law. Here on the show, our goal is to keep tax informative, simple, and fun. So if you're ready to talk tax, turn up the volume and dive into this episode of State Tax Talks. I think we found a natural segue here into the discussion of the tax credit. This is where I will hopefully start to sound less confused, because truly the environmental aspects of it in the regulation in Albany is familiar to me only in that we also deal with Albany on separate issues. But the tax credits brings it back into our world of tax here. And Joe, I know you've been itching to talk about your favorite topic, tax credits.
There's nothing more exciting than tax credits for remediated property.
I beg to differ.
You are the leader of the tax credit practice group, are you not?
Actually, co-leader. Mike and I are both leaders of the Brownfield Redevelopment Program.
Let's talk about the Brownfield tax credit. We'll start with the benefit of the credit, and specifically here, it's a refundable credit.
Yeah, and that makes a huge difference, because you don't need a tax liability in order to get the benefit, right? So with tax incentive programs that can only be applied to a tax liability, you see a lot more of, you know, selling the credits or bringing in an investor that can actually use the credits, ultimately, often banks, et cetera. But here, you know, with the Brownfield program, we don't see quite as much of that. You can still do that. You still may need to do that if you need capital in early. It's a mechanism to be able to get capital in early. But you generally don't want to do that, because then you're losing some portion of those tax credits to the investor. You know, you don't get 100 cents on the dollar for those tax credits. So here, because when you file your tax return to claim these credits, that's, you know, mechanistically how you do it. You get, if the tax credits come back in excess of the tax liability, and usually with these new development projects, there's virtually no tax liability, you get the state actually cuts you a check. So I've seen, you know, it's always nice to see, you know, oftentimes when we're representing taxpayers in fights with the department, you know, the taxpayer has to pay something at some point. And that's, you know, that's one thing. But it's always nice to open that envelope back from the tax department, and you pull out the check, and it's, you know, six, seven figures worth of tax credits, eight figures worth of tax credits. So that's always a wonderful day.
I think the victory of having the government pay you money is something that every American can get behind. So we mentioned briefly that, you know, there's a history of the tax credit program. We're on 4.0. And you said we've basically gone in a pattern of restriction, restriction, restriction. But now, reauthorization and expansion, which I'm wondering, is that due to the success of the program? Obviously, you noted the state's paying out a lot of money, but if they're loosening some of those restrictions, they must be, you know, reaping a benefit here also.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't say it so much on the, you know, the viewing the program as a success. I think it is, and I think they do view it that way. But I view the expansion of this program as more the state trying to target specific areas and industries. So it's renewable energy, it's affordable housing. Those are things that you're hearing a lot about, irrespective of the Brownfield program here in New York. And so what it did is just took those priorities and made, you know, added those benefits, or added some benefits to help foster development in those specific areas.
Exactly. It's really meant to kind of further the state's existing goals in a lot of areas. And affordable housing is a great example. You see a lot of areas, especially downstate, but you're seeing it more and more in a lot of areas upstate, where you just don't have a lot of great affordable housing options for working class Americans. So right. What do? You incentivize people to build those projects, and you give them credits to help do that. And affordable housing developers are probably the best equipped to increase their capital stack. So they're using not just Brownfield tax credits, they're using three other different types of program credits to make these projects work. And that's really how it intersects with economic redevelopment.
So let's talk about the tie-in between the credits and the cleanup. And you mentioned coming in at, you know, the beginning of this, so that eighth person in line who gets the certificate of completion is not themselves benefiting from the credit. The credit goes to the person who takes on the task of the remediation.
Yeah. So broadly speaking, you know, you get credits. The actual formula for doing this is very simple, right? You get your costs remediating the land multiplied by a percentage. The better you clean the land, the higher that percentage, period. It ranges between 22% and 50%, but the better you clean the land, the higher that percentage. So you take all your remediation costs, you multiply them by that applicable percentage, and that's your remediation credit.
Is that percentage determined by the tracts that we were talking about earlier?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Exactly.
So the credit calculation is relatively simple. Is there a cap on the credit? Like, is there an upper limit on how much you can actually get back?
Yep. And I mentioned that, you know, we're talking about remediation credits and development credits. That's our shorthand way of referring to this. That's not what the law calls them. You know, the remediation credits are actually two separate credits, a site preparation credit and then an on-site groundwater remediation credit. So those are two separate kind of categories, even though they function pretty much identically. They're separate, even though we're lumping them in for purposes of this conversation into the remediation credits. Then, and again, it's your remediation costs in those two areas, time that percentage. Then once you have this nice brand new or mostly remediated piece of property, what are you going to do with it? Well, the state wants you to develop on it. So then you spend a whole separate set of costs developing the property, whether you're putting a manufacturing facility or some type of mixed use space or retail, whatever it is, you're going to develop that property. And it's the same formula. You take your development costs, technical term of the tangible property component, but you take your development costs, you multiply that by a separate applicable percentage. And that applicable percentage now ranges between 10 and 24%. And that's the credit you get back for developing the site. So again, it's just your costs times the percentage equals your credits. And the percentage is, you know, for the remediation side, based on how well you clean the land. On the development side, it changes by a whole bunch of things. You know, again, everybody starts at 10% under the current program, and then you can get these adders, and you can't get above 24%. That's the cap. But you get these different adders, whether you're in a brownfield opportunity area or you're an environmental zone, or, you know, there's these different adders.
Or renewable energy.
System. Or now renewable energy, right. So there's these things that can get that can increase based on where you are or based on how you use the property, how you develop the property, that will increase that construction percentage.
Sounds like there is a lot of consultation that goes into one of these projects on the front end. Like, I imagine you, both of you, spend quite a bit of time with developers sitting down and being like, okay, how are we going to structure this so that it makes the most sense and you receive the benefit of what you are trying to do?
Well, I mentioned that I get involved very early for the structuring, for exactly what you just mentioned. And then I get involved late, usually when it's time to claim the credits, right? Mm-hmm. So you clean all this property, and then you get to claim the credits after the property is cleaned. Then you develop the property. And after it's developed, once the building is placed in service, that's when you claim the credits. And so there's a little bit of risk here. You have to recognize that all your work is done before you can actually claim the credits, right? So the state gets what it wants. It's got the clean property, it's got the development, and then you claim the credits. And so there's a risk that, you know, you're coming in, you've done everything you did under this agreement. Now the state's time to pay out. Is there any reason why those credits could be in jeopardy? And that's where, again, I come back in late to the project to defend the audit, to make sure that the state pays out the credits that are available to the project. And I can't tell you the horror stories that we've seen. Again, we weren't involved early on. I wish we were. But when we get involved late, because there's a disallowance and then an appeal of that disallowance of the credits, that's when we've got to start fighting. But the best time to fight that disallowance is actually way back in the beginning when you're structuring, when you're understanding how the program works. Don't ever get to that appeal stage. You don't want to be in an appeal situation, because tax credits are a very specialized beast within the tax world, right? You know, this is for lawyers, but the burden of proof to demonstrate that you are entitled to these tax credits is very high. It's higher than pretty much just about any other standard applicable to tax appeals. You have to demonstrate that yours is the only reasonable construction of the statute. And that's a very high burden. So it is best to avoid late fights, appeals, et cetera, by making sure your structuring and your early work on the project is tip top.
And I actually work with Joe a lot once we get the projects into the program, because there's a nuanced aspect of trying to show that the tax credits that you're going to be claiming and the creditable costs actually are directly associated or related to the remediation. And one of the interesting things that people always get confused, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation oversees and implements the brownfield program. They determine eligibility. They oversee you during the remedial project. They sign off on the remedy and go through it. Then when it gets handed off to the State Department of Taxation, the DEC has no involvement. And if you ask the DEC about questions about creditable costs, they'll tell you to talk to the Department of Taxation and Finance. If you ask them questions about, you know, issues that'll happen post credit claiming, they'll tell you, we don't know, we're not tax professionals. So it's really important that even though there's not a cross-sect there, the Department of Taxation and Finance, as Joe will tell you, will look to the decisions the DEC made and what was included in approved remedy documents and work plans and other things to determine whether or not something that you're claiming is a creditable cost actually was something that was necessary for the remediation. So the more you can do upfront during the program implementation to kind of solidify your positions and backstop things, the better you're going to be when you have to deal with audit.
So you have the DEC selling you on the program and helping you get involved and doing all the good work on the front end to structure the remediation. And then the tax department tells you, I don't know. I don't know if we want to give you the money now.
It's a very different MO. Let's just put it that way. I mean, I kind of view it, I don't work with DEC. That's Mike's department. But I kind of view them as kind of the salespeople. They're the people that want the property clean. They want, you know, to clean up New York. But I deal with the tax department. And the tax department has a very different animating principle, right? They are protecting the state fisc, the state budget. And they take the position that you are not entitled to even a dollar of tax credits until you have clearly proven your entitlement. You're not going to get anything unless if there's any question, if there's any ambiguity, if your records are unclear, you haven't kept good records for the development of the remediation, those tax credits are gone because you haven't proven that you're entitled to them.
And I should say, like any good bureaucratic program, there's actually a third entity that's involved. They don't direct the program, but the State Department of Health has a seat at the table when the DEC is signing off on the remedy and the investigation work happens. So anything else, when you get enough regulators in a room, sometimes it takes a little time to get through the process.
And if you want to get super technical, there's actually another entity that's involved in that. The tax department doesn't actually pay out these tax credits. They run the audit and they send their audit results, but that goes to the comptroller's office. And it's actually the New York comptroller's office that decides to cut the check once they review the tax department's audit results and sign off on it.
So I think all we're missing is a partridge in a pear tree.
Exactly.
Oh, the sweet beauty of four bureaucratic agencies controlling your destiny with different MOs, which is why we're sitting down and recording this podcast to bring all this information out there to people who are listening so that they don't dive headfirst into this having absolutely no concept of how this all works and flows together. Because it really is kind of a symphony of regulations and administration. And I could understand how people could get themselves into trouble or, you know, like you said, undertake these huge redevelopment remediation projects and then end up with, you know, less than what they thought they were going to get.
Yeah. And that's really what you want to guard against because, you know, there are those horror stories where developers have done everything they thought they were supposed to. And because of a very technical tax issue, and I can give you numerous examples of that, but because of a very technical issue, they end up losing a boatload or even all of their tax credits. We've actually seen that happen. So look, I don't want to be a black cloud over this. I really love the Brownfield program. I think it is extremely lucrative. I think it is the difference between some projects that are economically viable and those that are not. It can make the difference between them. So it's an important program. You should absolutely consider it. You just have to do so carefully.
And even on the environmental side, that's true because we didn't really talk about this, but let's say you do a limited phase two to determine what impacts you have at a site and you go in. Well, once you get into the brownfield program, unless you have a known issue and you're getting in under a remedial action work plan, meaning the department let you in with an understanding of exactly what the remedy is going to be, there's an expectation that you're doing broader investigation at the site. Now, those will be creditable costs, so you generate tax credit dollars. But if you identify a bigger problem than you expected, that could eat at your budget, your capital stack. And then you have a problem where you may be the owner of the real property and you've identified a bigger problem, you don't really want to do the project you were planning on doing any originally, but you're kind of stuck now. Because if you try and terminate the brownfield cleanup agreement, which you can, the next day the state will show up at your door with a consent order saying, congratulations, now you're going to do this under an involuntary program.
Oh, God.
Like I said, you just got to be smart early on. Yeah. Don't take it lightly. Don't enter it lightly.
There is a dark side to brownfield credits for those of you out there who didn't know. But well, mostly positive.
I was going to say, I hear that, but then I look at the downtown skyline here in Buffalo, New York, and a lot of that was brought to you by brownfield tax credits. So it's there, it's lucrative, use it, just be careful with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I would be remiss if we didn't touch a little bit on the audits of brownfield tax credits, because it's something that, you know, we certainly see in our line of work, Joe. Let's start out with the obvious question. Is it a big risk? Is there a big risk of a brownfield audit?
Yes, you will be audited. I mean, let's put it that way. You know, maybe that there may be some small amounts of credits that go, but when I talk to the tax department, their audit rate for brownfield tax credits is high 90s. So if you're going to claim a tax credit, it's going to get audited. Now, they try to be economical with respect to these audits. You can have a project that has, you know, 50 partners claiming credits on their individual tax returns, and they don't want to do 50 separate audits. So they'll just pick one or two and run the audit through that. And then once that audit is complete, they'll pay out the credits and make adjustments, if there are any adjustments, to all of the partners in the group. You should go into this program expecting, budgeting, and timing for a credit. You know, if you're worried about when the money's coming in, you got to budget in the fact that it's going to have to go through an audit. Mm-hmm. And that can take, you know, 6 months to a year, depending on how responsive the business is, depending on how diligent the auditor is and how, you know, how much they have on their desk. But it does take some time.
And are they just, you know, what are they looking for? Are they seeing patterns of things that are done incorrectly or costs that are included that shouldn't be, et cetera? You know, in your expertise, is there commonalities amongst these audits, or is everyone different?
No, there's definitely commonalities. You know, they basically start the audit by confirming that you're entitled to the credit. In other words, is the entity or individual that is claiming the credit really the proper entity and individual that should be claiming the credit under the paperwork, under the brownfield cleanup agreement, under all the stuff that was issued as a result of the project? And once, you know, that's usually a pretty quick threshold to get over. But once you get over that, then it's, okay, we get that you're entitled to the credit. Now it's, what is that credit? What's the amount of the credit? And there, it's just a matter of reviewing both set of costs, right? Both the remediation costs and the development costs, to make sure that everything that you've claimed, all those costs that you've identified on your tax return and used in the calculation of the credit, are in fact creditable. In other words, they satisfy the statutory definitions of qualified tangible property or site preparation costs. So that's really what the audit focuses on. And you got to be very careful. You know, auditors are looking to limit the amount of costs that kick off credits. And you have to be particularly careful with respect to the remediation costs, because that has a double whammy. Not only if an auditor successfully contests the remediation costs, not only do you not get that 22 to 50% of those credits, right, that are applicable to the remediation side of the ledger, but because there is now this cap, right, so there's a cap. The cap is equal to three times your remediation, the lesser of $35 million, or three times your remediation costs, or if you're a manufacturing site, $45 million or six times your remediation costs. You take that cap, and that's what applies to the development side. Right. So now you're never going to get more than, you know, $35 million or $45 million if you're a manufacturing site under this program. You get the lesser of that, or, you know, the cap based on your costs. But if you successfully contest the remediation costs, then not only do you lose those credits, but you lower the cap that applies to your tangible credits. And so it's like a double whammy. So you got to be particularly careful with what qualifies as site preparation, what qualifies as on-site groundwater remediation. And that's where, right now, maybe Mike can speak to this as well, but one of the biggest fights going on is, you know, what's a cover system and what qualifies as a, you know, remediation? Does the foundation of a building qualify? Because that's a cap that's keeping stuff in the ground. Does that qualify as a remediation cost?
Yeah, there was a huge fight over that, because you had brownfield projects downstate where they would say, okay, we're going to use a building foundation as a cap, but our foundation base is going to be 4 feet. That doesn't seem like that needs to happen that way. And the issue was, because developers were smart, they were doing it thicker, but that generated more dollars on the remediation side, which then they could leverage for purposes of the tangible redevelopment. So the department's position is they're only going to count a foot. You can have 4 feet, but they're going to only count a foot towards that. And over the years, as the program's been reauthorized, there's been nuanced aspects and changes that they've caught on to certain things to try and say, we're going to disallow this because it wasn't really necessary to effectuate the remedy you did. It was something on top of it or something distinguishable. Now, with that said, you know, it's always important if you get the DEC to sign off on a work plan that said that this was necessary, then it's harder for the, you know, Department of Taxation and Finance to independently question the DEC's judgment that that was necessary.
And Mike keeps using the word necessary. He's doing that purposefully because in the law, in order for a site prep cost to be creditable, it's got to be necessary to getting a certificate of completion. Now, we talked previously about the restriction of the program. Mm-hmm. That wasn't always the case, right? This word necessary wasn't always in the tax law. It used to be that you could get site preparation remediation credits if the costs were paid in connection to or in connection with getting a certificate of completion. Well, in connection with, I mean, I'm taking people out to dinner and we're talking about the site. We're doing.
I love, like, to a lawyer, the difference between in connection with versus necessary is like might as well be the distance between the earth and the moon.
Exactly. Like. Well, and the interesting thing is people sometimes don't think about this. Joe's time and my time on the project itself, that's creditable. Mm. Once you're in the program, attorney fees and costs and professional costs are creditable only to the extent, though, that it's necessary for the program. So if I'm advising a client on separate independent risk, as opposed to aspects that are tied to the program itself, you know, there could be an issue as to whether or not they would try and disallow those types of fees and costs. But you can qualify for that.
Joe, I know that one of the audit risks that we've talked about before is the potential risk that arises when programs are intentionally or unintentionally combined, that being credit programs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, the Brownfield program is just one potential funding source, right? So you can combine credits and get even more bang for your buck. It's just that you have to be careful because some programs don't work at all together and other programs don't work well together. And sometimes require some additional kind of structuring. So, you know, just for example, you know, you cannot take the Brownfield Redevelopment Tax Credit and any of the state's investment tax credits, ITCs, you know, whether it's the Excelsior or, you know, the normal investment tax credit, those two cannot be combined. But you can, and we often see the Brownfield tax credit being combined with, for example, the Historic Rehabilitation Tax Credit. So you got a big old building, it's been around for a real long time, and there's also some asbestos or some, you know, nasty stuff in the ground with respect to that building. Well, great. Well, now you've got an opportunity to use both of those programs in order to really reduce your costs, renovating, revitalizing, bringing back this historic but contaminated property. So you really, you absolutely can combine them. It's just that in certain instances, the way, even if you can combine them, the way that they are combined from a tax reporting standpoint can cause one program to reduce the value of the other program. Mm. And, you know, what this usually comes down to is just how the costs work together on a balance sheet and stuff like that. I don't want to get too technical on it. But point is, you just want to know going in exactly how the credits are going to work together. Is there any structuring you can do to avoid? Because there is, especially in that specific area, the historic and the brownfield credit programs. There are structuring ways to not have one credit diminish the other that you want to put in place. So yes, you can do it. You should absolutely think about multiple funding sources. Another good example we often see in these developments is, you know, grants. Well, you should and can take that grant money, but that grant money can't be used to pay creditable costs. It won't give rise to credits. So when you're applying for those grants, when you're taking those grants, you want to make sure that those are used to pay for non-creditable expenses or in a timeline that does not directly tie them to creditable expenses. So just things like that in terms of how you use your capital and how the programs work together are things that you definitely have to keep in mind. And then finally, you know, from a structuring standpoint, you've got to keep in mind that these are refundable and refunded often state tax credits. And that's great for state tax purposes, but that also means that you probably have additional taxable income federally. So you got to recognize that even though you're getting this bang for your buck from the state, there is a cost involved with that when you report this federally, because it typically creates federal income tax liability.
That's interesting. So you end up getting something back from the state and then giving something to the feds.
You bet. You gotta worry about that federal percentage.
Well, you know, if that isn't just the ultimate kind of cap on just how taxes seem to work out in the end, I don't know what is. This has been an excellent discussion, and I want to thank you both again for joining us. At the end of each episode, I like to just flip it back to each of my guests for some parting or concluding thoughts. So we'll go around the table to my left, and I'll start with Mike. If you have any concluding thoughts, now is the time to impart additional wisdom onto our listeners.
Yeah, I think what I would convey is the Brownfield program is a great opportunity to leverage risk in a manner that can both be beneficial to the community as well as to individual entities and operators. It's truly is an economic redevelopment tool, but it has been significantly helpful in a lot of communities where otherwise these types of redevelopments wouldn't happen. But with that being said, you have to go in eyes wide open in any scenario, because if you're solely looking at this from the benefit of the tax credit dollars, you need to understand what it is you're buying into, because there is risk no matter what.
Yeah, for me, you know, I'm a Buffalo guy, born and raised, always been here around Buffalo. And the biggest projects I work on are in and around New York City, you know, despite the fact that there are extra gates or extra hurdles to cross. But in Buffalo, we have literally changed the downtown skyline. In upstate cities, whether it's Buffalo or Rochester or Syracuse, there are these projects that fundamentally change the city, fundamentally change the area. And that's always great to see, and that's very gratifying. So I love working in this program. But as Mike said, you just got to make sure that you're doing it properly. You know, make sure early on that you understand the programs both from an environmental standpoint and then also from the ultimate tax credit flow.
That was without a hint of sarcasm. Very inspiring to think that you actually have a direct impact on the skyline of a city, and especially a city where I am also Buffalo born and raised. Mike, are you Buffalo born and raised?
I am not, but I'm a proud expat.
Oh, there we go. But yeah, to think that you can use a program like this to have that direct of an impact is really cool. Guys, thank you both again. This was a terrific discussion. And to our listeners out there, if you enjoyed this discussion, go back in our backlog of episodes on your favorite podcasting app and check out the other things that we've talked about. Don't forget to give us a 5-star review and subscribe and all those things that help us get the word out to more and more taxpayers and now fans of environmental regulation as well. This has been State Tax Talks. I am Joe Tantillo. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for joining us for another episode of State Tax Talks. If you're interested in listening to more episodes, we're available on all platforms where podcasts can be found, including YouTube. If you enjoyed this episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo, please give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. And if you're in need of a tax professional, you can contact the tax attorneys at Hodgson Russ. Go to www.hodgsonruss.com for more information. And until next time, I'm Joe Tantillo, and this is State Tax Talks. Catch you later, tax fans. The comments contained in this podcast do not constitute legal advice. The opinions herein are the opinions of the speakers and not the official opinion of the Hodgson Russ Law Firm.